Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 29 of the Pop Culture Coram Deo podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jeff Wright, and I'm here with the other regular host of this podcast, Jared Moore. Jared, been a little bit since we talked to you. How's life treating you, man?
I'm doing pretty well, man. Surviving, keeping at it, trying to get my prospectus approved. I've got a conversation, supposed to talk on the phone with Dr. Willem Wednesday, so pray that that goes well so I can get this thing rolling.
Yeah, I will pray for you about that, brother. And I'll just be honest with you. If I had a phone conversation with Dr. Willem, I think I would sound like Chris Farley on The Chris Farley Show.
Yeah.
You know, you remember that time you wrote that incredible book of theology? That yeah. was awesome. So,
well, imagine if he's like ripping apart your paper that you just sent him for 30. He said he wants to have a 30-minute conversation. So, so that should be it should be fun. It'll be good. It's good for me, but you know,
I know that I wouldn't have the intestinal fortitude to disagree with him. Like, yes, sir. That's so clear. Thank you, sir. Absolutely,
oh, yeah.
sir.
Oh, yeah. That's probably a lot of what it's gonna, a lot of what it's gonna be.
Well, good luck with it, brother. I will pray for you about that.
Yeah, thank you.
We're here this week to talk about the movie Searching, starring John Cho. I'm excited, Jared. I've been tracking that movie for a long time, trying to watch that thing, and wasn't sure I was going to get a chance to. It ended up showing up in Cookeville, so I went and watched it. I also didn't know if you'd get a chance to, because our schedules conflicted. We couldn't watch it together. Hey, but here we are, man, and I'm excited about talking about this one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was really good. Better, a lot better than I thought it'd be. Like, if you hadn't have said, hey, let's do this next, then I wouldn't have done it, but I'm glad you did.
Well, true story, I would rather watch that movie 17 times than ever watch The Nun again.
Amen. It was so much better than The Nun.
I think I would rather watch this movie in reverse than watch The Nun again.
Dude, you know what's crazy is I looked at on IMDb, it got a 5.8, The Nun did, and Predator got 6. Like, you gotta be kidding me.
Our standards as a society in multiple different ways are being lowered too far.
Hey, this one got a 7.9, though.
Man, it deserves it. The Rotten Tomato scores are great, and I really think it deserves it. I mean, I don't think it's a movie without flaws. We'll talk about that more, but mm-hmm. I thought it was really good, and I think my interest in trying to find that thing really paid off. But before we dive into Searching, we'll hit our first regular segment, which is watching anything good lately. Reading as well is eligible here. So, Jared, are you watching or reading anything good lately?
I just finished up Castle Rock, and I really, really enjoyed it. I do think there's some holes there, but hopefully they'll fill those in season 2.
Yeah, so you gave me a phrase about kind of the how this series is a blend of two previous, I don't know if I want to say franchises or series or what, but why don't you give that to our readers? Because I thought you were really spot on.
Well, it was like Stephen King and Lost got married and had a baby, and that's Castle Rock.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the baby was possessed by an evil entity.
Yeah, yeah. So, or just Stephen King, you know. Maybe he passed it on.
Well, we're watching this too, and Christy, who normally isn't into horror stuff, is watching it with me, and we're enjoying it. But I feel like for some reason we've hit this spot where, like, we can't get to the TV. We could have probably finished it up the other night, but we were like in a conversation, and she said, just put something on, and we ended up like talking through what we were watching, and we watched The Burbs with Tom Hanks.
Oh, that's an awesome movie.
Yeah, it was a really fun rewatch, even kind of, you know, eventually our attention drifted back to it, and we ended up watching it. But I wish we'd have used it to finish up Castle Rock, because I'm interested to see where it goes in season 1. And then 2, I've read some, I don't want to say negative feedback or negative reporting on the web about how it ended, but I've seen some headlines that made me think people, you know, weren't overjoyed entirely across the board. And so mm-hmm. I'm just curious to see it. So anyway, when I get it done, we'll get back on here and kind of give a mini review of that if you're interested.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
Now, what else is on your docket?
I'm looking forward to October, man. I mean, I'm a big horror movie fan, and I think horror has gotten better in the past, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. It just keeps getting better because it's getting cleaner. It's about there's still a lot of gore and stuff out there, but they're trying to make actual scary, you know, good scary things that make sense. make sense in the horror world. But I'm just excited, man. So Netflix has the House of Haunting Hill coming up. The Haunting of Hill House, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, there's a house on Haunted Hill movie and franchise. I mean, like, that phrase is tied to other horror movies, and so I don't blame you for getting it kind of twisted. Although it's not just like classic movies, The Haunting of Hill House. It's also one of the most famous, I guess you'd call it, horror novels by Shirley Jackson.
Okay.
Anyway, so carry on, though. I took us on a side trail there.
Listener, you need to go on Netflix. If you don't have Netflix, go on YouTube and watch the trailer for this thing. I mean, it's one of the best trailers I've seen in a long time for a horror movie, especially a series.
Yeah, I'm over the moon about this. So Mike Flanagan's the guy directing this. He's probably my favorite working director. I mean, that's a big statement, but every movie he puts out, now he works in horror, and I love horror. Mm-hmm. And so he's not Jordan Peele. He's not, you know, I don't know who you would put as the best. He's not Christopher Nolan. But for whatever reason, I consistently like his content, what he puts out, without fail. And so I just couldn't be more excited for this. The trailer looks incredible. For those of you who have watched the previous movies called The Haunting of Hill House, they're pretty strict adaptations of the novel. But Flanagan's taking it in a different direction. He's setting his story in the universe of Shirley Jackson's novel. So there will be common elements, but he's also telling new stories. And if that trailer is any indication, it's going to make Halloween awesome.
Oh, yeah.
So October 12th, right?
Yeah, October 12th. And I don't know if I guess the whole thing is dropping, ain't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how Netflix does it.
Oh, that'd be great. And then Hulu is starting an anthology October the 5th where they're telling one scary story every month for a year. And it's based on holidays. So they're doing Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, you know, and they're going to go through all the holidays. I mean, it's a neat idea. I just, I know Blumhouse is doing it, is part of it. And so,
bodes well. You know, Blumhouse doesn't bat perfectly, but their percentage is pretty high.
Yeah, I hope that both of these succeed because, I mean, as far as a horror series, good grief, give us something better than what FX has. What is it?
American Horror Story.
Yeah. American Horror Story,
I'm with you. I did watch the first season of that, and it was all I could do conscience-wise, and I've never been back. I'm with you. That, you know, that idea... Could the idea of one episode per holiday could be great, could be terrible, but I'm willing to believe in it with Blumhouse. I am going to ask you, though, Jared, what are you going to do when a satanic Easter bunny shows up?
I don't know, cry myself to sleep or, you know, I mean, it looks good. I mean, the previews look pretty messed up, but I don't know. I love scary stories that surround the holidays. I don't know, that sounds weird. I love the few Christmas scary stories I know, and then Halloween, and I mean, it's just fun, I think. But,
well, on that front, Netflix released the stuff that they're going to, you know, put out for Halloween this year, and some of it sounds incredible. Now, some of it, like they're showing Truth or Dare. That's from 2017. I have no interest in watching that movie, but on the first day of October, they're putting The Shining on. And then on the 4th, listen to this premise. It's a show called Creeped Out. It's an anthology series. And this is how they describe it. A modern day Are You Afraid of the Dark meets Black Mirror kids anthology series that depicts creepy tales and ends with a lesson.
Oh my, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, man. I mean, they had me at Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yes. I love, though, that growing up, and then even Goosebumps, and there was an R.L. Stine thing. It wasn't Goosebumps, but it was like
Fear Street?
No, it wasn't Fear Street. This has been in the past 10 years, 7 years.
Oh, I'm not sure what that would be.
Dude, I can't remember what it is, but I had it on one time during the day, and Amber walked through, and she about jumped out of her skin. There was like a giant doll that all of a sudden came up real close to the screen.
And, yeah, it was, forget that. but it wasn't based on Goosebumps, because like the best Goosebumps book was a living ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah, it was based on, it was something R.L. Stein, I believe.
Was Jack Black in it?
No. It was a TV show.
Oh.
I'll have to look that thing up, man.
Yeah, you should. I'd like to know what that is. I mean, I'm a sucker for those kind of shows. Do you remember back when we were kids, a show called Eerie Indiana?
Yes.
That was appointment viewing for me. I was a huge X-Files fan. That is right in my wheelhouse. And so anything, I mean, like I would probably try to find the show you're talking about and maybe let my oldest kids watch it with me just as an excuse to watch it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it will get them. Like it was I love the first season of Supernatural. I think that was the best season.
I'm with you. The idea of these two guys riding around the, you know, countryside hunting monsters and ghosts. I would watch as many seasons as they want of that. Like I gave up eventually on that show. I just kind of petered out in my interest on it, but them just riding around and investigating a ghost story and doing something to counter it, man, I'd still be watching that show.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I loved about it. You know, just like you said, two guys riding around fighting ghosts.
Well, so on the front of horror movie stuff, I guess we could let our listeners know about the project you've been developing. Do you want to spill the beans on that?
Oh, yeah. 31 Days of Horror, I guess is what we're going to call it, the Christian version. And I say Christian, it's just there's not going to be nudity or sex in it or overt crude language, like sexual language.
And we tried to shy away from just gratuitous torture and violence.
Right. And so there'll be that should drop within the next week. So it'll drop before the 1st of October.
Yeah. So what we're hoping for people like us who have an appetite for horror movies, but also have convictions about what we can consume in the stories we watch. We want to offer you a way to, you know, every day you can sit down and say, hey, here's a new horror movie as a way to kind of enhance. I don't want to say the lead up to Halloween. How about the lead up to Reformation Day? How about that?
There you go, man. Yeah, that's right.
So, all right. I don't have much to offer in terms of what I have been watching. As I just mentioned, we've hit a bit of a slog. We enjoyed The Burbs, but you gave us some good stuff there.
Hey, let me tell you, before we do, let me tell you the show. It's called R.L. Stein's The Haunting Hour.
Well, I'm writing that down right now.
It was 2010 to 2014. So on IMDb, Are You Afraid of the Dark got an 8.3. The Haunting Hour got an 8.1.
Okay. Well, R.L. Stein and Fear Street were one of the things that, one, helped me fall in love with reading, and two, fed my horror appetite as a younger person. So I'm definitely going to check that out. And if it's anywhere approaching reasonable, I'm going to hit my oldest son up and say, hey, watch some of these with me. Tell me what you think.
Yeah, man. I think I've only seen the first season, but man, it's good. I mean, it was good enough to return to, man. I want to say it's on Amazon Prime, but I think that's where I watched it.
Okay. I will look there first. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else you're watching, reading that you want to talk about, Jared?
No, that's it, man.
Okay. Well, then let's jump into our next regularly scheduled segment called...
So sorry to interrupt!
And Jared, we've got a few things to cover on So Sorry to Interrupt this week. You want to lead us through them?
Yeah, man. So first, let's start with who do you think the top three all-time comic book villains are and why?
I'm assuming that the upcoming release of Venom is prompting your thinking on this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's one of my favorites.
I love him, too. Just to be honest, I'm a sucker for palette swaps. The Black Spider-Man Secret Wars action figure is one of the you know, items from my childhood that I've never acquired that I still regularly go to eBay and see if I can find an affordable version of.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The thing I'm going to tell you, though, and this is, I'm sure you're going to push back on this later. Venom is too often a hero for me to consider him like a straight up villain.
Yeah.
So I think he's an awesome character. I just can't list him with my villains. So to answer your question, as a lifelong comic book nerd, I don't think anybody can answer that question without starting with the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there has been a lot of ink, even like to whatever degree this is applicable. There's been scholarly ink spilled about the Joker as a character. A guy we went to high school with did his PhD at one of the major state universities around here in comic book narrative. So
are you kidding? Who?
I'll tell you off air.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have another podcast about a comic book franchise, Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel, now being called Shazam by DC Comics, which is a frustrating point all on its own. But I do that podcast periodically. It was the first one I ever tried to start. And one of the guys who listens to that most faithfully is a professor at... At the time he first reached out to me, he's at Brown. He was at Brown.
Oh, wow. College of Rhode Island back in the day. First Baptist school in America.
Exactly. He's since moved on to like somewhere in Ohio, I think. But yeah, in pretty prestigious circles. And he had done scholarly work on comic books.
Dude, that's Ivy League. Yeah.
I know.
That's cool.
Yeah. So anyway, the Joker. And I think the reason the Joker is such a great character is that he is completely reinventable in any way you need him, basically, except for one particular point. And so he's a very malleable character. You can mm-hmm. have him as a crime lord gangster. You can have him as a volatile psychopath. You can have him as a terrorist. You know, he any way you portray him, he's believable, right?
Yeah, it's not like, out like of character. Jared Leto.
Like that portrayal of the Joker is the worst possible, right? But it's in the spectrum.
Amen. Yeah.
There's just so much
hard time.
Yeah, I know. I hate that junk. But you know, out of all that you could do with a Joker, that's what you do. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, for
that,
real.
That's my read on that. So anyway, yeah, he's completely malleable except for this. Like Batman, he has no actual superpowers.
Mm.
And so he is, all his threat is from his twisted mind. And there's something about that limitation that makes him even more compelling, like even more than a guy like Lex Luthor, right? Mm. Luthor is not superpowered, but he will go build a super suit. The Joker doesn't build super suits, at least not when the creator is handling him well.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to get, you know, red kryptonite and become an alternate Superman. He's there to express mental illness and chaos and evil. Depending on what you need him to do, he's going to portray that and make you believe it's a real threat, not just to characters you care about, but like in a way that looks like reality. So number one's the Joker. You agree or disagree with the number one slot?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, what have I not covered that makes you pick the Joker number one?
I think he's crazy. Like he's got a God complex, and so he loves chaos, but he's got to be the one controlling it. Like, and that's where he lives. So he enjoys seeing you squirm, like seeing his victims squirm. And I just think it's very sinister, you know.
And, well, that's a great point about chaos under control.
And I think that's what makes him so terrifying. Like all the things you said about he's very malleable. He can do all these. You can go many directions with him. But I think the point you made about it's possible that somebody out there could do this because he's not a super villain unless you say his mind is super. But he like the best Jokers that I've seen are those that stand toe to toe with Batman. With their own little gimmicks, like, you know, their own little toys, but not, like you said, not a super suit. Or you think of the movies that we've loved, it's when the Joker, you know, stood toe to toe with Batman with a small gun or an Uzi, or, you know what I'm saying? Like just as courageous, not courageous, but just as
unrelenting.
Crazy. Yeah. He's just an amazing villain.
Well, there's been, you know, a lot of Joker, and I don't want to stay here all night, but he subverts Batman, and Batman is the embodiment of justice. You hit on the central hypocrisy of the Joker, which I think is interesting, that yes, he's an agent of chaos, but it's chaos that he controls pretty specifically. And that is what made Ledger's portrayal of the character so compelling. He caught that perfectly, both in what Nolan gave him to do, but, you know, there's that scene where Batman and the Joker are in the interrogation room and Batman beats the trash out of him. And the Joker just says, "You have nothing to use against me. You can beat me till I'm dead, but I'm not going to buckle because I'm that committed to this scheme I'm pulling off." And he just, you know, Batman has no resources to use against him in that moment because the Joker knows Batman doesn't kill. And so
he has no one he loves either.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe other than maybe Batman. But anyway, we can talk about that a long time. But yeah, I'm with you. Joker, far and away, number one. Number two, it's a guy that I'm not sure how much you know about, not because it's some obscure character. I just don't know how much comic book material you've read on this. But I'm going to go with Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
Now, who is he the villain of?
Well, I want to say that he is the arch villain of the Marvel universe until you get up to cosmic level entities like Galactus or Thanos. Dr. Doom, in some ways, kind of plays the same role the Joker does in that he is the biggest threat that is available until you get to someone who can eat a planet. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So his backstory is he and Reed Richards were child and early adulthood rivals. Doom's intellect is only exceeded by Reed Richards.
Okay.
But Doom is also of European royal blood, and so he is the ruler of a country named Latvia, and he is also an experienced magic user.
Okay.
And the thing about Doom is that he's basically the most powerful mastermind-style villain. You know, these guys who are running things behind the scenes and orchestrating snares for the heroes. So he's that guy, but he's also, because he uses magic, and he wears an iron suit because he was disfigured in an accident that he blames Reed Richards for.
Yeah.
So he wears an iron suit. He's the ruler of a nation, and he uses magic. And so he can come at you from a lot of different angles.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, they can set him up to have ran a conspiracy that's going to ruin the lives of the hero. They can have him come at you as just a magic user who's got these supernatural powers. They can have him come at you as this master of technology, or a lot of times they pull his nation in, and like, he's using statecraft and international law against heroes. And so he's just versatile in that way. It's different than the Joker, because the Joker as a person is malleable. Doom is very consistently portrayed as a megalomaniac, but because of his range, you can use him in a lot of different ways. So I think he's, again, somebody out there is probably going to want to fight me over that. But I think until you get to that God tier, lower G God tier villain in the Marvel universe, Doom is the top dog. And he's so, I mean, he's been in conflict with everybody, but he is so associated with the Fantastic Four that he's yet another reason why it is such a shame that they've never been able to get a Fantastic Four movie really off the ground in a way that grabs people, because Dr. Doom would be incredible. Let me give you an example. So if you saw Infinity War, you know how they bring a spoiler alert to anyone who hasn't seen Infinity War, skip forward like 45 seconds. But you know how they bring the Red Skull back, and he's like in space and he's mystical? In the comics, that would be Dr. Doom.
Okay.
But he would also show up to fight Iron Man because he thinks his tech's better.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I'm going to go with Dr. Doom. You have number two as?
Carnage.
Oh, yeah. Tell our listeners who Carnage is if they don't know.
Yeah. So Carnage is from Spider-Man. I actually don't know his real name. You know his real name?
Cletus Cassidy.
Cletus Cassidy. And what is scary about him is that, well, there's no motive, there's no goal. It seems that he just goes around killing people.
Yeah, the name's very fitting, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I just think that's terrifying when there's no narrative that's driving this. Because usually if you think of real killers, you can you can figure out their motive, you know, or their reasoning, or then you can maybe answer that. But the only way to, you know, the only way to stop Carnage is to want to end him. I mean, and so I don't know. Do you think he'll make an appearance in Venom?
Yeah, I do. In fact, I think we have confirmation that he's going to be in it.
Oh,
and,
really?
I think it's confirmed that he's going to be played by Woody Harrelson.
Oh, wow. That's good casting.
Yeah. So what you just said about Carnage is right. In the comics, he was a serial killer who ended up getting a suit that was an offspring from Venom. Right. So he's much like Venom, only the guy inside the costume isn't a man with a conscience. It's a serial killer. The closest I've ever seen to his characterization in a movie, and this is not an endorsement or a recommendation, I'm just acknowledging that I've seen this movie, but it's Natural Born Killers with Woody Harrelson in it. It's people who just love to kill for killing's sake. And if Harrelson channels his character in Natural Born Killers, he will get Carnage spot on, but he'll also be, because of Harrelson's abilities, he'll be an incredible character to watch on the movie screen.
Oh, yeah. It'll be terrifying. I mean, you think of maybe the worst serial killer in American history, whoever that might be. Imagine if they had super ability.
Yeah, somebody like Albert Fish. You know, just pure evil. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, that's just super creepy. So I think Carnage for number two.
Okay.
Who's your number three?
Number three, I'm kind of, I guess, going to look like I'm in contradiction with my point about Venom, but I'm going to go with Magneto. Mm-hmm. Magneto is sometimes portrayed as an anti-hero, kind of the same way Venom is.
Yeah.
But Magneto is best when he is a villain and he's doing evil stuff. But the thing that makes him so compelling is that he has the best argument for why he does evil stuff.
Yeah, good call.
So his family were victims of the Holocaust, and it taught him that if people he cares about are going to be protected, there needs to be a power that ensures that his people are taken care of. You know, he's very Nietzschean in that way. Like, it's just, this world is a conflict of powers, and that's the only element in the equation. And so he's not going to let, you know, his people, mutants, suffer what his people, the Jews, suffered at the hands of Nazis. And so he does awful, atrocious things, but he's got the most tight logic for doing it. And so I'm going to go with Magneto on that.
Yeah. Did you see the latest, what was it? Apocalypse, X-Men Apocalypse?
Yes, I did. I think I watched it in the theater. I never went back to it, but I watched it in the theater.
I thought that was a good portrayal of Magneto. I thought they did a really good job with it.
Yeah, it is a shame that his lifespan overlapped with like the Marvel Cinematic Universe the way it did, because Ian McClellan is the perfect actor for him as like mature Magneto. And the guy who plays him, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but the guy who plays him as young Magneto is in the exact same vein. Like, and he captures where you're like, I would like to be able to like this guy and sympathize with him.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Out of all the stuff that has, you know, that Fox has gotten wrong with the Marvel characters they have really nailed Magneto and I think Professor X and obviously Wolverine.
Yeah, good call on all three of those, man. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And so your number three is?
I put Venom. I've always loved Venom since a kid, man. Just very compelling. But I see what you're saying as far as, and that's how they're going in this movie too, it appears, where he's more like a vigilante, I guess, vigilante justice with a conscience. He basically does what you and I would feel like doing probably, when it comes to, you know, punishing bad people or people who are, you know, the system isn't going to get, even though, you know, as Christians, we're supposed to trust that God has ordained the governing authorities and what they fell at, he's going to avenge one day. Or even what they, you know, everybody's going to answer to God, even people who have paid to the state, you know? But anyway, so, revenge stories are tempting. And I think that he's kind of got this revenge bent, which makes him a villain in my mind, but
it's one that you can kind of like, I don't know. There's a way to enjoy seeing revenge, right? Like, you can kind of, what you appreciate about justice, you can get a bad counterfeit of in revenge.
Yes. And the thing is, though, a lot of folks are, I mean, a good revenge story leaves the person empty.
Yeah.
You know, one that's complete, because revenge isn't as satisfying, you know, as people let on. And I think, you know, and this is going to be odd, but listener, if you follow the Larry Nassar trial at all, I want to encourage you to go look up Rachel Denhollander's, I think it was like a 25-minute statement against him. But he had abused her. He had abused hundreds of girls, but he had abused her. And she responds in, my goodness, in an amazing, gospel-centered, gracious, loving way to him, offering him the gospel. I mean, it's just beautiful. You can go find that on YouTube, and it's very convicting. very convicting. But
yeah, talk about subverting evil with good. She embodied that very well in that I don't know, in that dynamic, I guess.
It's incredible. Incredible.
Man. Yeah. All right, so there's our top three comic book villains. The Joker takes number one by consensus, Dr. Doom and Carnage respectively in number two, Magneto and Venom bringing in the three spot. Listener, get at us. We went pretty deep on that one, so yeah, get at us and let us know what you think. I think you got some more stuff to throw at us in this section, though, right, Jared?
Yeah, man, I want to mess with you on holidays. So what is the better holiday, Halloween or Christmas?
I mean, you know this podcast is aimed at a Christian audience, right?
That's right.
You kind of paint me into a corner here.
That's what I love to do, man.
The answer is clearly Halloween.
Yeah, I explained that.
Well, I only mean it in terms of how a post-Christian culture celebrates both holidays.
Okay.
So that's my qualification. It is objectively better to celebrate the incarnation of Christ than it is the celebration of the supernatural on Halloween. The problem is Halloween in our society is so fundamentally broken. There's no meaningful connection to the incarnation apart from what happens in local churches.
Wait, are you saying Christmas? You said Halloween.
Yes, Christmas.
Okay.
I mean, in some ways, I like Halloween better than Christmas because I'm so disenchanted with what we do with Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize a lot of people out there are going to have to be charitable listening to me say this. I'm not saying anything people don't already know. The crass commercialization of Christmas,
mm-hmm.
the reduction of it to good tidings among neighbors for no good reason, no ultimate like ontological reason. We're just going to have a winter holiday that we're supposed to be nice to people. And then even, so I want to be gentle with my Christian brothers and sisters on this. I really do mean this as like a brother within the fold, but the empty sentimentality of even what takes place in the church, where the idea of God becoming flesh and dwelling among us ends up being about like nostalgic memories and bygone eras, things that I'm not opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're applied to what is supposed to be a meditation on the doctrine of the incarnation, they just become heinously inadequate. So
you're saying the culture's driving the church kind of when it comes to how we celebrate Christmas, and it should be the Bible driving the church's celebration of Christmas.
Yes. Now, again, I want to try to be charitable. I know there are countless churches out there whose community is not falling prey to this. It's just so hard to find it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm thankful for the church community I'm in. I'm thankful for people like you that I know who are, the reason for the season. That sounds so trite. But, I mean, see, that's what I'm saying. Like, even talking about it seems mm-hmm. consumed with cliche that has become meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I am thankful and I'm aware of lots of people that are working really hard for Christmas to be, again, a meditation on the incarnation and rejoicing in Jesus. And the Father who would provide him and the Spirit who would compel people to know him. Like Andrew Peterson, his Behold the Lamb stuff, that's been mm-hmm. a huge help to me. There are people in my church who are like, Jeff, you're just broken when it comes to thinking through Christmas. Let us help you enter into the joy of Christmas. And they did it in part by helping me plug in with what Peterson was doing. There's good stuff out there. I don't want to minimize it. But if you're part of American society, it's just so hard to find, or at least I've found it in my experience, it's so hard to find those pockets of oasis in the wash of just empty sentimentalism and empty, I don't know what I want to say, like this foundationless, good, happy mood that you're supposed to be in arbitrarily at the end of December.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess a lot of this is an indictment of Christmas, but I'm going to pick Halloween because it's one of the few holidays we have that doesn't have those sort of empty religious overtones slapped on it. Now, for me personally, talking about speaking as an American, me as an autonomous unit, or me and my family as an autonomous unit, we celebrate Reformation Day on October 31st. But if we weren't, we'd be doing Halloween. We would be trick-or-treating and giving out candy and really having a blast there. I guess in some ways with Halloween, it's better because there's just no pressure to jazz it up with the trappings of Christianity that are actually empty, you know, that are actually not all that meaningful the way there is in so much of American Christmas celebrations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And it serves as a warning, you know, to our listeners who, you know, how they celebrate Christmas and how we emphasize it with our families and our churches.
Yeah, I don't want to beat up on anybody. Let me just be clear about that. Like my church has helped me see that I've just taken too cynical a read on this. I'm sort of being rehabilitated through this anyway. Yeah, that's the stuff that hits me the hardest in the Christmas season.
I enjoy Christmas, but it's because I bring my presuppositions to the stories and the, like you're talking about empty sentimentality, empty be good for goodness sake, things like that, moralism for no ultimate foundation. But whenever I see those things, my presuppositions, so why I celebrate the season and why I enjoy Christmas better than Halloween, but I do enjoy Halloween just because it's fun. Like similar to you, it's a cultural holiday. Without the, you know, we get to dress up and goof off, and the kids have a blast. I mean, they're adorable, running around, enjoying candy, having fun, and I love seeing that as a father and participating in that with them. But I love Christmas for very similar reasons, and how we get to reflect on. I like Christmas as well because it forces people even in America, even in post-Christian America, in many ways they're still confronted with the reality of God the Son incarnate. I mean, even it's funny when I watch some shows that they're playing these Christmas songs, and there's still great theology that gets into to what they're singing. You know, they may not realize it, but I mean, even in like Hark the Herald Angels Sing, that's one of the best hymns that's ever been written, in my opinion.
Sure. Maybe my favorite hymn is Joy to the World.
Yeah.
Now it was written, best I understand it, Wesley wrote it to be sung at the Second Coming.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But that's it's been pulled into Christmas, which I'm glad to see happen because I get to sing it more often. Right. You know, if I had to keep it in my pocket for the Second Coming, you know, I'm still waiting on that one. But the fact I get to sing it at Christmas, that's it. That's another thing with churches. One thing I would just say is as a believer who has, you know, some relationship to the church, I really do think Christmas songs ought to be sung year round, the good ones.
Yeah.
I think we do a disservice by relegating them to one quarter of the year or one month of the year. You know, Joy to the World, Hark the Herald Angels. I'm trying to think of the ones.
Hark the Herald Angels.
What did I say? Sorry.
Hark the Herald Angels Sing is what it's called.
Sorry, my bad. You can tell. It's a little rusty in my thinking there. Even a song like Once in Royal David City. Yeah. Are you familiar with that one?
No, huh?
It's not the deepest one ever, but it's a meditation on the idea of like God come to earth. And I think these things should be sung. I just think, sing them all year round if they're really worth singing.
Yeah, amen. I agree, brother.
Here's the metaphor I want to give you, Jared. And not to come back around to like, I don't want anybody to, I guess in some ways I'm just trying to acquit myself, but I think of Christmas in our day in the way I think of Jeroboam building temples at Dan and Bethel when Israel and Judah split. So if you remember that, it was politically advantageous to Jeroboam to say, don't go to our southern rivals in Judah to worship at the temple. Mm-hmm. You can worship the God of Israel at Dan and Bethel, which is unauthorized. He put statues in there to represent the living God. That's unauthorized. Mm-hmm. But this was all done sort of in the name of worship of the one true God, except every bit of it was counterfeit and blasphemous. And so I'm not saying everything in Christendom, you know, whatever, you know, to use the term some people talk about, like the remnants of Christendom in America. I'm not saying everything that happens in our country at Christmas is Dan and Bethel, but so much of it strikes me as just in the same vein.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that makes sense.
It's hard for me to see past it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, I'm going to go Halloween.
All right. So moving on to number three, man, what are the top three scary movies of all time since we're getting close to Halloween?
Yeah. Well, we're getting close to an hour on this podcast. I mean, you're bringing out the deep waters here. So I'm going to answer this in terms of how scared I was when I watched it the first time. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Top three scary movies of all time for Jeff Wright. Number one is The Exorcist.
That's my number one too.
You know, most people recognize it as one of the scariest movies of all times. I believe demons possess people. And I thought Friedkin did a really good job of capturing the awfulness of possession and the blasphemy of possession and the assault on the dignity of an image bearer that possession represents.
Yeah.
And so there's stuff in that movie that I wish I could scrub from my brain. And
yeah,
I'm not going to endorse it to any of our listeners. Obviously, I've watched it and have it in some kind of admiration. I don't think that everybody's conscience can stand watching that movie. But on the other hand, I do know Friedkin wanted to do something generally positive with it. He wanted to say something about the supernatural. I think self-consciously in his own mind as a professing Christian. So yeah, I have been scared by that movie in a way that no other movie has ever shaken me.
Mm-hmm. What you got saved because of that movie, didn't you?
I didn't get saved, but I mean, in some ways I may have thought more seriously about the supernatural ramifications of my faith because of that movie.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, it puts evil right in front of you.
Oh, yeah. Evil that's hidden, right?
And yeah, but that will leap out on you and make you deal with it. I mean, and mm-hmm. that had a plan to do you harm. I mean, a lot of stuff that basically growing up in the sheltering household I did, it just wasn't part of how I thought through Christianity. So that's my number one. Sounds like you agree. What did I not cover when I was extolling the power of that movie?
No, I think you're right, man. And there were some freaky scenes in that as well that, I mean, just the abnormal, you know, contorting of the body and crawling. And I mean, there was just some creepy things that I don't think had ever been seen before.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so it was just a masterpiece in many ways. And I think you've said it is one of the highest grossing movies of all time. Mm-hmm. In its day, it grossed over $1 billion. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right, at least adjusted for inflation. I think in raw numbers, Muschietti's It eclipsed it last year, but adjusted for inflation, it's still the highest grossing horror movie ever and one of the highest grossing movies ever.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. I tell you what we'll do. I mean, we're going long already, but if you'll remind me after we get done with reviewing Searching, I will tell our listeners a story that involves you and I and The Exorcist after the credits roll. So
yeah, that'd be great.
All right. What's your number two?
My number two is the original Chainsaw Massacre, 1974.
You have to justify that one. I hate gory movies.
Yeah.
So you just tell me.
Well, the reason why it terrified me, like I based it on how scared did I get the first time I watched it. And see, I had heard that it was loosely based on a true story, that there really was this family and that they never found Leatherface. They did lock up one of the family members, but they didn't catch the others.
Hmm.
And so just the thought that this guy Leatherface could still be out there. And I don't know, it was just terrifying to think of someone that big and that strong. And I mean,
demented.
He could run like a 4.34 you know, with a chainsaw.
It's Reggie White with a chainsaw.
Yes. I mean, it just terrified me the first time I saw it. Like, it's still, like you talk about scrubbing things from your brain, that movie is still in my brain too. The Exorcist and the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Well, you'll understand my pick for number three then, because it's rooted in some of the same motivations. Number two for me, I was truly on the edge of my seat and really scared by Paranormal Activity, the first one.
Yeah.
That movie, I think we forget what a phenomenon it was. It was not a broad release. The way they marketed that movie was they would show you clips of audience reactions to it and then ask you to petition your local theater to bring it in.
Oh, wow.
And man, me and my wife went to that one as a young married couple, and I was on the edge of my seat. And to this day, again, this is spoiler territory, and if I'm spoiling Paranormal Activity for you, I'm very sorry, but it's been out for a hot minute. There's a scene when the wife has been taken over by the demonic entity that's tormenting them, and we see her watching her husband sleep. And then the timer starts running forward, and you realize she's been doing this for hours. She's standing over him the way that a wolf would stand over an injured calf.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. There was a lot of stuff in that movie that was scary, but the thought of someone that you love and trust in a moment of complete vulnerability, just observing you with predatory eyes, that just rattled me. I'm sorry.
I'm laughing.
That's okay. It really did rattle me. A movie that would have normally made this list, but it's so similar to The Exorcist, I didn't put it on, is one that we've covered in our archives, The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yeah.
And the scariest scene in that movie is when the guy who, this sounds like it's going to be sexual, but it's not. Emily, in a place of torment, goes to find a friend on campus and says, "Will you come back to my dorm room with me?" Just as a comforting presence. And he's with her in her torment, and they both eventually fall asleep. But when he wakes up, she's on the ground contorted and staring up at him in the grips of what we're led to believe was a demonic episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, that's the scariest part of that movie for me. Cause just that, you know, like, God forbid, and I mean that without being flippant, God forbid that my wife ever get a mean spirit in her to like scare me to death one day. Because me waking up with her staring at me with like a mean look on her face, that may be enough to put me in coronary, you know, failure. So
it was so funny. The reason why I'm laughing so much, dude, is that Christy is tiny. Like you could probably throw her as far as you could throw a football. Not quite as far.
I've tried a couple times and it's not, you know, I can get a little bit more air with the spiral.
But it's just funny because I just pictured tiny Christy staring at you and it freaking you out.
Well, I'm glad you guys didn't know this. Like when we were spending the night at various youth camps and stuff, we were speaking and, you know, or like we were serving as chaperones for each other's youth group. If y'all had known that about me, I'm assuming I would be in glory right now. I would have woken up dead. So
we definitely would have done that. Yeah. I mean, I still may try somehow. I don't know. Maybe we go to the SBC together or something.
Well, to that, I just say, you should hope it kills me. Because if it doesn't, I will have my revenge.
Jeff's revenge.
Yeah. My number three on this is kind of the same deal with you with Chainsaw Massacre, which, by the way, I mean, I guess you know, it is based on a true story. It's just not a family. It's one guy, Ed Gein, who also inspired Buffalo Bill in the Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, wow.
And also Norman Bates in Psycho. He's one of the truly twisted and disturbing stories in American lore. But my third is The Strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what you said, this idea that there are people out there. It's kind of what you said about Carnage and the Chainsaw Massacre. There are people out there who are quite happy to find their entertainment in violence.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't, there's not always a rhyme and a reason to it. I remember one time reading, true crime's always been an interest for me. And I remember reading one time an interview with a serial killer who said, and he was asked, "How did you pick your victims?" And he said, "Often it was just whoever's door was unlocked."
Golly, that's off. That's so scary.
Yeah. And he was operating right when the idea of a serial killer was just developing, or we've seen in recent days, why can't I remember the name they call it? It was the East Area Rapist, and they ended up realizing that he was a different, that he was also another more prominent serial killer in Sacramento in the 70s. But anyway, they found him through DNA testing, like somebody sent in DNA, and they realized this person was related to a DNA sample they had of this guy.
Oh, wow.
So the Hillside Strangler. Anyway, that there's just evil people out there who will drop in on you like an unexpected storm and rain terror and pain and even death on you. And then they very well may hop into a car and drive down the road and really be untraceable. You know, I've heard police officers say that like the truly random act of violence is almost impossible to to track down legally. And so just the strangers as representative of random evil. Watching that movie, man, I was just wrapped up in fear.
Wow. Yeah. It was that's a good movie too.
Yeah.
I put Muschietti's It from 2017.
That's a good choice.
Yeah, there were several scenes in that movie. And listener, you can find it in our archives, Stephen King's It from 2017. And there are several scenes in that movie that I didn't expect. Like when Pennywise jumps out of the projector and he's huge. And I so hope part two is clean enough where we can review it, you know? I hope they do it right. I think they did part one right. They were good with the story concerning the book, but they left out the unneeded things in that book that would. I think there's a lot of needless things in that book
for sure.
As far as description,
there's stuff in that book that I can't believe did not end Stephen King's career.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope they leave that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm hopeful with Muschietti that he'll do what he did with part one. So, but anyway, I found it terrifying. I found it, you know, and I saw it obviously in my mid-30s, and so. That's my number three.
That's a great one. Hard to argue. There was a lot of people who turned out to the theater who hadn't watched a horror movie in a long time to watch that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good list, man. Good question. And again, we went long. Those of you who like our long episodes, you're getting all the content you want this week, but good question. Glad you asked it. That will bring us though to the end of
So Sorry to Interrupt.
So, Jared, you want to get started on searching?
Yeah, let's dive in, man.
Okay. Just a couple of notes here. Well, let's start with a summary. So, I cribbed this from IMDb and modified it just a little bit. Tell me what I got wrong, all right?
Sure.
Here's the summary. After his 16-year-old daughter goes missing, a desperate father enters her online life to look for clues to find her.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. All right, guys. So there is there's the last spoiler-free element of our analysis of the movie Searching. So if you haven't seen this movie and think you might want to, this would be a good time to hit pause. Or if you're happy to have the movie spoiled for you, you've seen it already and want to hear the analysis, press on. But just beware, spoilers ahead. Jared, what about conscience warning?
I'm thinking, you know, there's some bad language. There's some crude language. There's a few sexual references, but other than that, there's hinted at violence, but you don't see violence.
Well, I mean, I think you see John Cho get into like a brief wrestle fist fight.
Sure.
But it's not violence like, you know, we just talked about The Predator in our previous episode. It's nothing like, it's not violence in the same way.
Even Next Gen was worse, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was cartoon. I mean, a Marvel movie, much more violent. There's a couple really crude references to sexual stuff. There's one really disturbing part of that movie where for a minute you think that incest has taken place, and that's in there. That momentary, where they're suggesting that to you. That may be too much for some of our listeners, and if it is, we would encourage you to obey your conscience and not watch this movie.
Mm-hmm.
A few notes on the movie. I mentioned that I've been looking for this for a long time. I first saw the trailer online. I didn't see it in the theater. And I noted that it was supposed to be released in early August. And so I got to early August and I thought, where's that movie at? And I found it and I saw, oh, it's going to be released on August 3rd. And I thought, well, it's August 4th or 5th when I'm looking. Where's this thing at? And I got on Fandango, no listings for it anywhere. Well, it turns out it was pushed back to a limited release on August 24th. So I eventually found that. I thought, okay, August 24th, cool. I'll watch it then. Same deal. Went to find it. It was showing in like the biggest of metropolitan areas. You know, we live fairly close to Nashville and Knoxville. And usually between the two of those, I can find a showing of a movie in limited release. Wasn't there. And I just thought, man, am I ever going to get to see this movie? But then it went on wide release August 31st. And then like 2 or 3 weeks later than that, our local theater got it. So this is a weird one. Everybody who was watching it either in advance or as it kind of got more and more broadly released loved it. But it just seems like theater chains were reluctant to pick it up. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's the best movie that's come out this month so far.
Yeah, good call.
Did you ever see Unfriended in 2014?
I believe so. It's the one where they're all on a chat. Like, it's not the latest Unfriended, right?
Yeah, that
it's
was called Dark Web. I haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. I saw the first one, yeah.
So there's a similar movie called Friend Request.
I saw the Unfriended. It's basically built around a girl, brown-headed girl.
Yeah, she was bullied.
Yeah.
embarrassed. The video is put online. She kills herself and kind of comes back to take her vengeance. I thought of Unfriended a lot watching this movie, because that Unfriended film, a lot of it took place in like a chat window or a Skype session or a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's happening on searching as well, right? You know, we spend a lot of time watching him log in and look through cookies and internet mm-hmm. search history. Well, it turns out the same producer worked on both movies.
Okay. And that makes sense.
I saw on IMDb this little Easter egg. At one point, we're looking at a Facebook screen and there's a trending topics list on the right side.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the trending topics is Laura Barnes, which is the name of the girl who ends up being the malevolent ghost in Unfriended.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a cool little detail. Speaking of details, and this is going to get more into the matter of the movie, but did you catch the mascot of Margot, the girl who disappeared, the mascot of Margot's high school?
Mm-mm.
They were the catfish.
Were they really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And you see that, you know, this movie, going back and thinking through it, this movie drops a lot of clues to give you what you, to get you, if you're paying attention, to know what's coming at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But when I noticed, so you see like this montage of Margot's life with her family, you know, you see her as a little girl with her mom and dad, and she's developing, she's playing piano. Eventually mom gets cancer, it goes into remission, but then it comes back. Then you see like Margot is growing up with a single dad, and it's tracking, you know, you through her different phases through photographs and stuff. But they show you pretty early on her starting high school, and it's her and dad in front of the sign for the school. And again, it says home of the catfish. And in my head, I just immediately was like, that no high school has the catfish for their mascot.
Mm.
And that term is, you know, too kind of relevant right now for that not to mean something. And so the whole time we were watching that movie, I was like, she got catfished.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of wish they hadn't done that.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. When I saw it, when I knew who the killer was when the boy, so it was late in the movie, it was when the boy opened the door while his mom was talking to the dad, you know, the female police officer. That's when I thought, okay, he did it. Because why else have him walk in? And
yeah. And in some ways, she's kind of too big an actress to not, you know, to not be super important. You know, she would have been important as just the detective. But that's another thing that I think some of these movies do. They telegraph the surprise by having some, you know, the most prominent actor in the cast basically play the role.
Yeah.
Another thing that they doled out that I realized later is, you remember she tells him that she covered for her son when he was running a scam.
Mm-hmm.
He created a fake charity.
Mm-hmm.
But do you remember the amount of money he raised?
$500?
$2,500.
Oh, was it really?
And I think at one point she mentions it. Now, she says he ran a scam in the neighborhood, but she says he eventually took $2,500 from one woman.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And, you know, looking back on it, and if you remember too, early in the movie, they show a news report about a hiker who had disappeared but had survived on rainwater. And
Yeah,
looking back on it, there's a lot more that became clear, you know, in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like you, by the time I was constantly looking for catfishing. I knew the mom covered for the son in unethical behavior. And when he comes in the door, it's just hard not to be like, oh, why did they just remind us that he's part of this world?
Yeah.
And I read online, I didn't catch this, but I read online that when he's going through a database trying to recreate Margot's friends, that her son's name shows up in the database on screen. And the details that he has listed in the spreadsheet is that he had a crush on Margot and that his mom was a police officer.
Oh, wow. Goodness.
I didn't see that one. I read about it online. But if you're, you know, if you're someone who appreciates breadcrumbs, but breadcrumbs actually do lead somewhere if you pay attention to them, this movie is really good for that.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of telegraphing, though, ain't it? I mean,
it is. And I mean, maybe I'm thinking too highly of myself, but even as someone who was like, that catfish thing, you know, it set off an alarm in my head. a lot of this stuff wasn't clear until I was looking at the movie in hindsight. So I'm sure somebody out there is going to say, I saw it coming along, and I bet they're right. But for me, it was almost perfect. If I hadn't seen the catfish thing, I probably would have been much more surprised by the end of this movie.
Well, how much, what was the rating on this? PG-13?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I bet you they marketed this towards teenagers, or they expected teenagers to go see it.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, this won't work for my family. I'm assuming we'll have other examples. This will look a little dated. But, you know, you got to think through your children. But if I had a teenager, particularly a young teenager who maybe I'm trying to slowly introduce to the world of social media, I'm probably taking them to watch this movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a little ham-fisted in terms of like, the idea that basically the detective helping investigate your daughter's disappearance is the mother of the culprit, that's mm-hmm. a little out there. But pretty much everything else in this movie could and very often does happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to watch it, it was like one of the last days that our theater had it. And it was the afternoon show. And I was in there in the credits for a long time. I thought, okay, I'm getting a private screening. But eventually, three people came in. And it was a mom and a dad and a teenage daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's a good move. So only other note I've got on this is that we spend a lot of time on computer screens in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it pretty much felt like, I thought it felt realistic for a tech-savvy dad moving through an online world. You know, he wouldn't know everything, but he also wasn't one of these stereotypical old dudes who's like, hey, what are you doing on the Book of Faces? And, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It kind of looks like the way I move through the internet. And some of it, again, some of it's Hollywood stuff, but some of it's very realistic. They did a good job with that. And I thought Cho did a really good job because a lot of this movie is just the camera in his face and he's doing all his acting with just his facial muscles. And mm-hmm. I thought he really pulled it off.
Yeah, he did well. I mean, it was good all the way around.
Yeah. Well, that's enough film notes. What about, let's start chopping this thing up, looking at it in comparison to the story God's telling in cosmic history. So, Jared, what's the creation view in Searching?
It's set in today's world, so a world that's basically full of social media and everybody and their brothers on it. Teens especially relate to one another largely through social media. I mean, adults do as well, but teens, I mean, you and I do, but teens do especially. And so I think that's kind of the world that is. It's a dangerous world, much like our own world. And even nailed teens being kind of naive about the dangers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it was very well done. But it's today's world very much.
Yeah. I thought that, you know, when we talk about creation in God's story, creation is the original goodness in which God created the cosmos. And there is goodness in this, in that this is a family story. And this is a family who has taken a major hit in the loss of a mother. But it's clear that dad loves daughter and daughter loves dad. Now, there's disconnect between the two. He doesn't know her as well as he thought. But that this is a loving family is pretty, pretty clear. And it looks like the good that's built into the real world, or at least should be there by God's design. I realize not every family's healthy and happy and loving. But, you know, the idea of the family as a nurturing and launching environment is part of God's design. And this movie reflects that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's fallen?
I put fall happens when teens do not get what they want and parents don't have strong relationships with their children. And I put that because of Margot, basically what happened to her, the reason why she was running to friends on social media is because she didn't have any friends in real life. And, she's eating it when he finally realizes she's eating lunch by herself, and he realizes, well, did she have any friends? And she kept going out. The reason why she was at the lake is because she didn't have friends to fellowship with. She would just go there and take pictures of it. And she had friends on social media, but not in real life.
It's a counterfeit community, right? I mean, yeah. It gets the way that social media becomes a deceptive, false community where it looks like you've got all the friends in the world, but you're the most lonely person that you know.
Yeah.
I mean, cancer's here too. Cancer's part of fallenness. Cancer takes comes into this family's lives, takes away a young mother and wife from the husband and daughter that loved her. People are, you know, are alienated just by virtue of sinful humanity. You know, dad doesn't really understand daughter. Daughter doesn't really understand dad. They don't know how to connect perfectly. That's all. It's all a product of human sinfulness. Maybe not intentional, willful sinfulness, but that's just part of our alienation from our Creator working its way out in our relationship with our neighbor.
Sure.
What about redemption? So God did not leave his good creation that was defiled in the fall in that fallen state, but he decided to redeem it through King Jesus Christ, the God-man. How does redemption take place in this movie?
In this movie, it's, well, when teens have real relationships with their parents and their peers.
Yes, yes. I'm going to add in, I don't know which one's the strong element, but this father pursues his daughter. He is dedicated. Once he realizes she's in trouble, he gives himself to the project with vigor and persistence. And this dad ends up rescuing his daughter in a very good way. His care, once activated, brings her back home in safety. And so that looks a lot like a good father who sent a rescue agent to bring his children back into his household.
Yeah, good call. Yeah. Hey, maybe you need to do a series on searching.
You talking about a sermon series?
Yeah.
Hard pass. What about glorification? So in cosmic history, the Redeemer accomplishes his father's aims and he builds a better world. What does glorification look like in searching?
I put glorification happens when technology is seen as a tool for relationships, not something to replace them. And also glorification happens when parents know their teens beyond merely being their friends, you know, parents being parents, which includes knowing teens' lives, like knowing who they are, what they like, who they're hanging out with, where they're, you know, he should have known. And I think that's the point, one of the main points of the movies, that parents don't really know their teens if they don't know who they're talking to online.
Yeah. I would also say by the time we get to the end of this movie, what didn't kill them made them stronger. And so they have come out of the suffering that took place, and they are again rebuilding their lives and appear to have found some healing. And so the father's redemptive work has really set them up for a literal better future.
Yeah, good call. Yeah. Even though she's paralyzed, isn't she?
Yeah, I think she's able to still play piano, I think, but she is in a wheelchair. Now, maybe that's a temporary thing. They don't actually explain that. She's healthy enough to be back at school, but maybe she regains the use of her limbs or something. I don't know, but it does look like she's at least, handicapped from the waist down. So friends, once we kind of chop the story up into those elements of creation, fall, redemption, glorification, in some ways, we want to put it back together in our own thinking as we think about how we can appreciate Christ's glory through this story and how also we can serve our neighbor or our brother in the church, talking through and highlighting themes of this film. So we ask ourselves several questions. The first is just what's the story? And we want to take pains to get that right. We hope we've done that in the worldview analysis. The next question is to locate ourselves in the story. You know, what's this movie asking us to think about ourselves? Where should we find ourselves in the ideas of this movie? So, Jared, where are you in the world of searching, in the story of searching?
First off, I want to say just something about how it's shot. I mean, think about just the concepts of, okay, a dude sitting in front of a computer screen, clicking on social media, clicking on... I mean, how to make that compelling and to not bore the people watching the movie to death is pretty amazing. And what they were able to accomplish, I wasn't bored at all. Even though I'm looking at him searching through his daughter's Facebook friends and taking little notes. And I mean, I wonder how many minutes he's sitting in front of a screen and we're just seeing what he's looking at and doing, you know? And so they did a really good job telling the story and showing that from his perspective. And I thought that was really well done. Second, I thought that they got teenagers right. You know, oftentimes through adolescence, you know, teens are they're trying to break away from their parents. And it's common, you know, it's not ideal, but it's common for teens to start to hide things from their parents. To basically they're learning and practicing that autonomy that they're desiring. And it's common for them to be curious. It's common for them, unfortunately, to be naive. about the various dangers in the world, and especially right now with apps. And so Cho in this movie, so her father, Margot's father, he's at the age, it appears, that there weren't apps when he was a kid. Now, he's tech savvy, but he does not participate in these apps himself. And so he doesn't know all that happens within the apps themselves. You know what I'm saying? And so there's a learning curve that he doesn't know about, and all this. He doesn't know the dangers that are there. But the point of the story is he doesn't know because, well, he hasn't made it a point to know. And so he's responsible for that. So what happens in this movie could really happen. Not only could it, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Missing persons. I don't know how many times a week or, you know, once a week at least, you get an Amber Alert on your phone. This big blows up your phone and a lot of that is dealing with social media where someone has – actually, I just saw this morning where a youth pastor was arrested. I can't see where that was. I don't remember where it was. But it was through social media that he was trying to solicit teenagers.
Yeah.
I can't remember where that was. But he ended up with a detective on the other end and ended up arrested for it. But so it's a dangerous world. And what it is, what makes it dangerous is that people – so what you're seeing with social media – is, and this movie gets it right, at least somewhat right, that when people don't think that they can get caught, this is what they do. Like, they can hide behind an alias and be anonymous and say whatever they want to say. And so the sinfulness of their heart comes out.
Yeah.
And so if they're desiring inappropriate things, they'll just say that. They wouldn't say that to your face. But through an alias on social media, they'll say it. And if the recipient bites on that, they'll try to set up a meeting place and all these crazy things. And, but what it is, it's being anonymous and thinking that one can get away with it. And the devil uses that. And we've seen that we saw that in this movie, you know?
Yeah.
But finally, I identify with the father. You know, his desire to protect his child, and I identify with his assumption that he can, you know, that he can protect her. And it's not only her who's naive, man, he is.
Sure.
And
absolutely.
I am.
There's so much there I want to talk about. I mean, you and I both have a youth ministry background. And I remember when I was doing student ministry that I was always struck by how common it was for parents not to have a category that their kids would be tempted and even engage and give in to temptation to do sinful things.
Oh, my dude. I wrestled with that like crap. I would beg parents, do not. So parents would literally let their 13, 14-year-olds go, you know, after school by themselves back to his house. And I would beg them not to do that. Do not let them. Do you not remember when you were that age?
Yes, exactly. That, you know, that was always my thing. Like, I know you want to believe the best about your kids, but remember when you were a teenager, what was in your mind and your heart, even if you weren't able to express it, what was there? I can't remember because you and I were so much in conversation at times. Sometimes the stories blend together a little bit for me, but I think it was in my student ministry group where that exact scenario was playing out. And this young lady's parents were letting her go on dates where they just went to the boyfriend's house by themselves for hours on end.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to the parents about the lack of wisdom there, the mom said, well, we kind of need to give them the benefit of the doubt until they prove they can't handle it.
That is so crazy.
And I remember just thinking, like, would you do that with a loaded gun? Would you do that with a car? Would you do that with a bag of weed? Like, what are you talking about? Give them the benefit of the doubt till they prove they can't handle it. They're like 14 and 15. Their bodies are loaded weapons.
It's like they desire these things, or at least they're tempted by these things.
Yeah, their flesh desires it.
Yeah.
Why put them in a crisis situation where, anyway, I don't want to beat up on those parents. I'm sure I'll have blind spots too, but I just remember being like, we've got to have a healthy skepticism about the sanctification of our children.
Yeah.
So yeah, the other thing, what you just said about the power of anonymity, it's hard to say what the most corrupting influence on our society is today, but the power of online anonymity and what it can do to otherwise, you know, upright people is mm-hmm. staggering. You know, you're just walking through some news you read. There's someone close to me who is a dear friend who I legitimately love and look up to in the faith, but anonymity gave him, and I say gave him, like it gave his sinfulness the room it needed to grow and took him to a place that he would never dream of going. And thankfully, mm-hmm. the Lord has brought healing and protected him from, you know, hurting people. But you know, it was all rooted in too much anonymity online.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the solution is to that. I really don't. But I know that that's the kind of thing that we need to be in conversation with our Christian friends and our elders and spiritual leaders over, because just getting to be someone different online. You know, Brad Paisley, for those who listen to country music, he made a joke out of it years ago by saying, "I'm so much cooler online," because he could build a fake persona.
Mm-hmm.
But you can be cooler, you can be wittier, you can be better connected, you can be more dangerous, you can be more hateful, you can be more antagonistic, you can be less Christian online and feel like you're getting away with it. You know, of course, the eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the earth, so you're not getting away. It's not ultimately, you know, anonymous, but you can sure live in that delusion for a long time. And again, that anonymity can corrupt you.
Amen. And I think you hit the nail on the head. What keeps us from evil online is ultimately our view of God, our theology. And I realize that we've got to believe that consistently in order for it to keep us from it, right?
Well, I think you also have to have like safety measures put in place through like people who will hold you accountable.
Yeah,
I don't think you can just take your high view of God alone into a social media environment and come out on the other side without your conscience inflamed.
Yeah, I mean, I assume. I would push back against that some, and just say that it should, but. I mean, God should be enough, but oftentimes we do need more accountability, and it's different for different folks too. You know, I don't know what it is,
Well,
I can
I'm
speak
with you
as a man, you know,
yeah.
But I don't know about women. I don't know.
Sure. I'm with you on that it should be, but much like the power of anonymity, or rather much like what we said about letting teenagers have freedom to show themselves unworthy of freedom or, you know, unable to safely handle freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I just think so few people are able to safely assume that they can go into that world anonymously without another set of eyes regularly checking up on them. I just think most of the time we should be skeptical about someone's, I don't know, it's not spiritual strength, fortitude or conviction or whatever it is. I think most people are going to need some help here.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing there, Jared, talking about parents being naive, I just read a study where 28% of parents polled thought that it was possible or likely that their children had online social media accounts that they as parents weren't aware of. And 76% of teenagers polled in the same polling had anonymous or alternative social media accounts that their parents were unaware of.
76%?
Yep.
That is insane.
Yeah, some of these are a little bit more innocuous. So like Instagram is one of the platforms that was highlighted. And apparently there's just such pressure to have the coolest picture. I mean, I sound like an old man, the coolest picture, but to have the best picture and the best version of yourself out there, that sometimes these kids will create an alt account that's got the same username, but then they'll add like spam to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there they'll post more authentic stuff, like the shots that didn't turn out quite right and whatnot. Now, there's all kinds of evil and wicked uses for that same principle. But again, some of it is not just like trading nudes and, you know, the worst things that immediately come to mind. I'm sure there's worse things than trading nudes even, but that's not all that's happening with these alt accounts, but it often is. But yeah, 76% of kids said they had two and sometimes three alt accounts and their parents were only aware of the original account they had.
Good grief.
Yeah.
That blesses your heart, doesn't it? So you can let your kids have any social media contact.
Yeah, when they're living outside of my house and can pay for it themselves. I mean, we've talked about it in previous episodes. My kids will be like, yeah, you know, some of my classmates, and we're talking fourth, fifth grade, third grade. Some of my kids are getting, or some of my fellow classmates are getting phones. When can I? And I'm like, son, you just need to forget that it's a possibility. It's going to be so far away from now that you're going to just be depressed if you think it's happening any time in which you can anticipate it happening.
Oh, man.
And don't get me wrong. I want to teach my kids to use the technology.
Mm-hmm.
I want to teach my kids to safely use a shotgun. They're not going to get a shotgun. They get to take out of my house and do with it whatever they want for 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm talking big and bad as a dad. I'm trying to think through, like, again, we've mentioned on previous episodes, there's more power in a smartphone than there is in a circle saw. How in the world could I let myself turn my child loose with a circle saw? Well, I mm-hmm. couldn't. I sure can't let them do it with a smartphone either.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I agree.
So the old man's climbing off the soapbox here. Jared, what's good, true, and awesome in the world of searching or the story of searching? Where do we see common grace?
I think it gets the danger of the internet right. You know, the internet is a dangerous place because people believe they can deceive people, get what they want, and never get caught, you know. And so I think giving sinners, you know, people who are tempted to do evil things, the ability, or at least tempt them to think that they can get away with something and never get caught, is a dangerous thing. And so the internet provides that. Now, I'm not anti-internet, but it is dangerous. It can be dangerous. And it's dangerous, especially for the naive, for those who don't see the danger.
Dangerous, though. I mean, he uses internet resources to track his daughter down and stuff. And I think it shows some good that can come. I mean, we think that the internet helps provide a lovely podcast known as the Pop Culture Quorumdale Podcast.
That's exactly right.
I met some of the best theologians and ideas and theology through the internet. So just to reiterate what you said, we don't think it's all bad, but it holds a world of potential for evil.
Sure. I think the movie gets a father's love right. Fathers should love their daughters. They should feel a responsibility to protect them and to, you know, if they go missing, they should do exactly what he's doing, going after them and not stopping until they're found and protected. The movie gets good and evil right. You know, there's a clear good and a clear evil in this movie. You've got two parents even. You've got two parents, two teenagers. Both parents are trying to protect their children, but one is protecting an innocent child and the other is protecting a guilty child. Protecting the innocent is praiseworthy in this movie, while protecting the guilty is evil. You know, the police officer, even though I think the movie wants you to feel a little empathy, but, you know, or at least understanding, like, well, I understand why she did it, but the movie does portray her and her son as wicked.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The thing too is that, like, hidden evil gets exposed.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's very consistent with what the Bible says will happen to those who attempt to hide themselves in darkness doing evil deeds. The other thing too is that this movie has a lot of good that comes out of seeming hopelessness. I mean, a lot of ways this movie ends on a resurrection. And that's also very consistent with the way God has ordered his universe and the story he's telling about his son through it. So, I think that's part of why we both like this movie. There's a lot of really rich, good stuff here.
Oh, yeah. Amen, man.
You know, the other question is the second to last question is the inverse. What's distorted, evil, and false here? How can we subvert idolatry?
Parents should seek to know their children and protect their children from evil that is out there in the world. So, I mean, that's a positive thing. But the greatest enemy of our children is their own sinful hearts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the greatest enemy is not out there, but in the hearts of children. And so danger, and not only that, but danger is everywhere. We can't just lock our kids up in the house all the time. Even the home can be dangerous, even though we think it's, you know, the safest place there is. Even if you don't have the internet, you live in a dangerous world. I remember, well, you probably remember this too, Jeff, that a father took his daughter, it's been probably 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more like 3 years, but they went sledding, I think, up on Bonaire Mountain there in Sparta. And she was on the front of the sled and her friend was on the back, I believe. But they hit a concrete mailbox.
Yeah.
And the girl is, I think she was 16, received brain damage. And I think she's wheelchair bound. And she cannot, it affected the part of her brain that she cannot speak. Mm. Like, if I'm not mistaken, she can't communicate, but she can perhaps blink her eyes or write.
Yeah.
And so so you can imagine knowing what you know, but not being able to communicate like you can, you know, it's just a very frustrating thing. And that was supposed to be a fun thing.
Yeah.
And not only that, but do you remember when, well, I probably shouldn't say his name, but when so my cousin, they were all goofing off. And you remember when it was cool to come up behind somebody and stick your knee in the back of their knee and make their knee buckle?
Yeah.
He did that to her and it blew her knee out.
Right.
And I mean, so it's just, there's danger all around because there's not this, I mean, God is sovereign, but his meticulous protection is not the same in creation as it was in the garden.
Yeah.
And there's this assumption in this movie that if you know all that your kids are doing and all their friends, and that they will be protected. So this movie doesn't answer, it doesn't get the curse right and therefore can't answer it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, some of that's really chilling and just reminds you of how vulnerable we are, man. Yeah. Well, Jared, maybe on a more positive note, how does the gospel apply?
So since we live in a dangerous world, you know, we need a father and a savior that are greater than the world, that are greater than the curse. You know, we need a father who's both holy and just. You know, when Adam and Eve sinned, God had to remain holy. I mean, he ceases to be God. So he has to act according to his nature. And he told them that on the day you eat of that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall surely die. And so when Adam and Eve sinned, God had to remain holy, and he freely chose to pour out his love on these two sinners and their posterity. So he did not immediately kill them. They didn't immediately eternally die as God told them they would. Instead, they died spiritually and were placed in a dying creation, a cursed creation. But also in that creation is something known as common grace to counteract that curse. And so you have this, we live in a cursed creation, but there's so, it rains on the just and the unjust, and all of our provision comes from God while we're in rebellion against him. And God prophesied to the serpent, told him that there would be a day when this seed of the woman would crush his head. Now, the serpent would bruise his heel, but he would crush his head. So there's this seed of the woman who's coming, Jesus Christ. And that's all the way back at the garden. And he's going to overturn the curse. You know, God is the ultimate father we need, and Christ the ultimate savior. You know, Jeff, you and I, our earthly fathers, we must seek to mimic our heavenly father, but our job is not to be ultimate in our children's lives, though we are, at least when they're young, but our job is to point them to a greater savior than us, to a greater father than us. And by serving second fiddle to the Trinity, to the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, we actually become better fathers, because we're being the fathers that God the Father has called all fathers to be. Mm-hmm. For his glory.
Amen. Amen. When I think about the way this movie presents fatherhood, I may not be able to get through this without it getting dusty in here, but I think about the Jesus Storybook Bible. I'm not the last person who's going to quote this, and I'm certainly not the first, but, you know, telling the story of the fall and God's eye toward a future day, it says that God loved his children too much to let the story end in their fall. Even though he knew he would suffer, God had a plan, a magnificent dream. One day he would get his children back, and one day he would wipe away every tear from their eyes. Next sentence, if I can get this without bawling. You see, no matter what, in spite of everything, God would love his children with a never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love. One of the best lines in a book that's chock full of them, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just makes you really thankful for a father who loves his children that way. And in some ways, not perfectly, but in some ways, searching puts that in front of your eyes.
Oh yeah. And I mean, like my daddy's went to be with the Lord. And so all that I appealed to him for, I now run to my Heavenly Father even more. And he's more than sufficient.
Amen. Amen. Well, all right, man. We went long form on this one. Anything else you got to say about searching?
No, it was a great movie. You know, listeners, you need to get out and watch it.
Yeah, yeah, I think we would commend this one to you wholeheartedly. Jared, I penciled in Venom for our next episode. It got a PG-13 rating. I haven't seen anything yet specific about what content's in there, but I'm hoping it would not be so conscience offending, or it may even be edifying enough that we would review it. So do we want to pencil that one in?
Yeah. Well, when does it come out?
I think it comes out next week, doesn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was in October, like 12th or...
Oh, I thought it was October 5th. We'll check on this and see, friends. If it's October 5th, we'll be talking about Venom. If not, anything you want to suggest, Jared?
I have no idea, man.
All right.
No,
well, it's either Venom or we'll get back to you, listener.
You're right, October 5th, but that's 2 weeks away.
That's right. That's right. 2 weeks away. All right. So we got to find something. If you guys want to nominate a movie, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook. We're at PCCDPod, or you can get in our Facebook group, the Pop Culture Quorum Deo Podcast Perpetual After Party. It's a long name and a great group. get in there. Let us know what you think about this episode, what we need to review before Venom comes out. Any thoughts you have, we'd love to hear them. And we're thankful for the people who participate in that group. We would also be thankful if you're willing to give, if you're willing to do this for us, give us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We really appreciate the 5-star reviews. But if you don't feel like you can give one in good conscience, hey, leave us what you can. Either way, those reviews help us know how to improve the show. And it also tells iTunes or wherever else you're listening to these podcasts, maybe you should tell other people about this show. So again, if you're willing to give us that review, we would greatly appreciate it. So thanks in advance. And of course, thank you to all those of you who have done so already. Jared, where can they find you outside of the world of the Pop Culture Quorum Deo Podcast?
You can find me on Twitter at Jared H. Moore. You can find me on Facebook at All Truth is God's Truth. Be sure to check out our blog on patheos.com/blogs/Pop Culture Quorum Deo, especially for that movie series there that we're going to be releasing here this next week, the 31 Days of Horror, the Christian version.
Absolutely. All right, man. Well, I'm going to say thanks to all of our listeners for hanging in there with us through this episode, and we hope it was profitable and enjoyable to you. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to reach out to me outside of the world of the podcast, I'm at Right Jeff on most social media platforms. Jared's got another podcast. Did you mention All Truth is God's Truth?
Yeah, it's All Truth is God's Truth. You can find it on wherever you listen to your podcast from.
Absolutely. And you should do that. Guys, we will be back to you pretty soon, letting you know what the next episode is going to be about. But until then, thanks for listening to this episode of the Pop Culture Quorum Deo Podcast.
Hey, what's that story?
So let me just tell you about the time I was an innocent victim of Jared Moore and another friend's evil schemes. So we got to remember our age range. When we graduated high school, there was this brand new technology known as the DVD. And I had people in my life who loved me enough to be very generous with their graduation gifts. And part of what I did with that money was I went out and bought a brand spanking new 27-inch CRT TV and a DVD player. And the first DVD I bought was The Exorcist. And I was dating a young lady at the time who I knew if I could get her to watch The Exorcist with me, she'd be scared and she would want to snuggle up. And I thought that would be a great way to get some snuggle time in with this young lady I was dating. And I told my brilliant plan to my friend Jared Moore and another guy who we were friends with, and they knew the night that I was going to show The Exorcist to my girlfriend. And I lived, talking about giving teenagers too much freedom, I lived in the basement of my parents' house. I don't currently live in the basement of my parents' house, but I did then as a high schooler, or just graduated high schooler. And I had multiple entrances to my room that, you know, you could enter from the outside of the house. You could come in through some French doors right next to my bed, or you could come in through the garage door, which had one wall and a door separating the garage from my bedroom. And so while I am in there watching The Exorcist, and about the time that Reagan gets good and possessed and starts looking scary and doing scary stuff, the door between the basement and the garage flies open and slams against the wall. Now, if you can picture me in that moment, one, I'm kind of freaked out myself. Surprise, surprise, that door didn't fly open by itself all the time and bang up against the wall. So I'm a little bit scared. This is nothing compared to the young lady watching this movie with me, though. She goes into full-on catatonia. She is horrified, and like, if she were a computer, it would be the blue screen calling for a reboot. She just shuts down, freaked out. I don't know anything else to do except get up and go investigate. So I hustle to the door, look around, call out to see if my dad, like, had a fit and threw the door open. Nobody responds. I go running out the garage door to see if there's some human culprit that I can check. And I step out. I grew up in the country. So I step out of my dad's house and into his backyard, which opens onto a pretty large pasture. And it's just me, the stars, and the cattle. And I am deeply shaking. And I go back in again. This poor young lady, she's beyond consoling. So I make the decision to take her home because I know she's just scared out of her wits. I take her home. She's so scared that she asks me to sit in the chair in her bedroom until she can fall asleep and then asks me to slip out without waking her up. And I do that. And I spend the rest of the time that night, the next day, wondering what in the world happened to that door. did a demon provoked by my watching this movie about demons choose to manifest itself? And I think I got back to youth group. Do you remember when y'all told me?
It was a while away. Like, it was, I don't know if we waited a week or.
Yeah, it was long. I remember stewing on this for a long time.
Because we didn't think that it affected you. Because we threw the door open and snuck out and ran back to the car that was parked like a quarter mile away and drove off. Like, we didn't know that if it ever. We didn't even know if you were in the basement. Like, we didn't look to try to see you. We just assumed, you know, we knew your car was there. And so we didn't peek in or anything. We just took that door, flung it open, and snuck out and ran back to the car and left.
Yeah. Well, it did, buddy. And I am no longer.
A few weeks later.
Yeah. I remember y'all let me stew on it for a long time. And I really had no viable theories. You know, I guess probably if somebody put a gun to my head and said, what do you think happened? I would have had to punt to the supernatural.
I helped your sanctification.
Yeah. I'm not in contact with that ex-girlfriend. She lives in town, but we lost touch years ago. I would not be surprised at all if she still has nightmares about that. She was scared to death.
Yeah, that movie's awful, man. I can't imagine something like that happening.
Yeah. But, hey, with friends like these, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. It had to be a providential thing, man. I didn't know y'all were watching, but the guy who was with me probably knew.
Yeah, he did. I know he did because we talked about it. I thought I'd talk to you about it, but he was the one who had first bought The Exorcist and showed it to me.
Oh, okay.
And so, he knew. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was his idea.
For sure. Yeah. He probably made you do it against your will, didn't he?
I did do it. I think I was the one who threw it open. I mean, we're lucky we didn't get shot, man. I mean, that's in the country.
Hey, almost the exact same scenario. Almost did get one of my friends shot.
Yeah.
One of our friends shot. I'll tell that story on a different podcast sometime.
Oh, man. That's a great story.
All right, guys. So there's a little bonus Pop Culture Quorum Deo for you. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to y'all soon.